Well, thank you all for getting up nice and early and coming out this morning to this wonderful venue. It's great to be here. And let me also start by thanking the Finance and Treasury Association for the opportunity to speak to you today about the transmission of monetary policy. So as it was said, in my current position at the Reserve Bank, I oversee the Financial Markets Group. And among the many other things that we do, we spend quite a bit of our time analysing financial market developments around the globe, as well as in Australia. And a key task there is to consider the ways in which monetary policies are affecting economic developments. And so the first stage of that transmission process is the effect of policies on financial conditions. The second stage of the transmission, which I won't address today, is how those financial conditions then influence business and household decisions regarding how much they're going to invest and consume, and the size and nature of their balance sheets. So the first 2 years or so in my current job, they were characterised by a degree of stability in financial markets. So just taking one example as shown here, 10-year government bond yields. They'd increased through 2016, but they were moving in a relatively narrow range over most of 2017 and 2018. Yields were drifting a little higher in the US to just above 3%. They were stable within a range of around 2.5% to 3% in Australia. Much lower than that, but still positive and stable in Germany. And little changed, around zero in Japan. Meanwhile, stimulatory monetary policies, they were gaining some traction. Spare productive capacity in economies was being absorbed, with unemployment rates declining to relatively low levels and wage growth gradually picking up in a wide range of advanced economies. Now, there's quite a bit in this chart, but essentially it just shows you the net share of advanced and emerging market economies either tightening policy rates or easing policy rates in the past 6 months. So in a number of advanced economies, as you can see here, with inflation at or close to their targets, central banks were removing some stimulus. Most notable, of course, was the US Federal Reserve, but it was not alone in raising its policy rate. Moreover, market pricing suggested that monetary policies in a broader range of advanced economies, including in Australia, were more likely to be tightened rather than eased, even if that prospect was still some way off. And then through 2018, higher US interest rates were placing some external financing pressure on a number of emerging market economies, particularly those that had unhedged exposures to US dollar debts. And partly in response to those pressures, a large share of emerging market economy central banks had raised their policy rates over the second half of that year. Well, that picture of a steady improvement in economic conditions and gradual removal of monetary stimulus has changed significantly since late last year. Just a couple of weeks ago, the US Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, they reduced the federal funds rate. And the Reserve Bank of Australia has also reduced the overnight cash rate in recent months, as has the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. Moreover, market pricing implies that a number of central banks in advanced economies are expected to reduce policy rates in the coming months. And central banks in a large share of emerging market economies have also reduced their policy rates. So the dashed line here that takes us to half of the central banks that I've listed in the advanced sphere as easing policy is based on those market expectations. So in the rest of my presentation, I'm going to outline some of the reasons for this change in the stance of policies, and then I'll turn to the response of financial markets to those changes, with a focus on some of the key aspects of the transmission to financial conditions in Australia. So this shows you the market's view of the likely course of monetary policies in the major advanced economies, and that has changed quite noticeably in the past few months. Just as a starter, this shows the actual reduction in the Fed funds rate of 25 basis points that occurred quite recently, and then also two reductions for the RBA in recent months. So in fact, it was 2 weeks ago that the US FOMC reduced the Fed funds rate by that 25 basis points. And at the time, the chair of the FOMC, Jay Powell, he emphasised that the US economy remained strong and that policy easing should be viewed as a mid-cycle adjustment. In other words, I think more of a course correction than a reversal of their course. And so the FOMC emphasised that it was responding to subdued inflation and the downside risks to the outlook for US economic activity. And the FOMC also noted that the easing in global growth reflected most recently in a softening in business investment. Given all of this and the recent ratcheting up of the US-China dispute, market pricing currently suggests that the Fed is expected to lower its policy rate by a further 100 basis points by around this time next year. And while US economic growth has held up reasonably well, growth in the euro area has slowed more noticeably. And at its recent meeting, the European Central Bank, the ECB, emphasised that it will provide additional stimulus in the absence of a further improvement in the outlook for inflation, which has averaged just under 1%, averaged under 1% for the past few years, and that compares with their medium-term target of close to but just below 2%. Should further stimulus be necessary, the ECB noted that it could lower its policy rate, strengthen its guidance on the future path of policy, and indeed resume the expansion of its balance sheet. Market analysts expect a package of such measures to be announced in September, and market pricing now implies that the ECB is expected to reduce its policy rate even further into negative territory. It's currently at minus 40 basis points, and the expectation, therefore, of another 20 basis points at least would take it to minus 60 basis points by the end of this year. And meanwhile, the Bank of Japan recently emphasised that it will consider additional easing measures if momentum towards achieving its inflation target were to be lost. And accordingly, the market participants expect the BOJ will lower its policy rate by 10 basis points to minus 20 basis points before the end of this year. And given the increasing concerns about downside risks to growth around the world and generally subdued inflation pressures, market pricing implies that policy rates are expected to be lowered in a number of other advanced economies. Here in Australia, with growth having slowed to a below-trend pace and inflation pressures subdued, the board of the Reserve Bank reduced the cash rate at its June and July meetings. The board noted that although employment growth remained strong, there'd been little inroad made into spare capacity in the labour market recently, with the unemployment rate having risen slightly. Financial market prices currently imply that the cash rate is expected to be reduced by a further 25 basis points later this year, and then again in the first half of next year. So towards the end of... let me talk now about the how financial markets have responded to this. Well, of course, before the end, towards the end of 2018, the trade disputes were weighing on manufacturing, trade and business confidence around the globe. A broader easing in the pace of economic growth in some economies was also emerging, including in Europe, as I just suggested, and in China. And financial markets had responded to those developments and the rising concerns about the downside risks to the global outlook in an environment of subdued inflation. And of particular note, longer-term interest rates turned down. Those declines are extended more recently as the market reassessed the outlook for monetary policies, as well as the outlook for growth in light of the ongoing downside risks. And with expectations that policies are likely to be more stimulatory than earlier anticipated, and with inflation pressures subdued, interest rates right along the yield curve, as shown here, have declined noticeably over the past year. Yields at 10 years are back below 2% in the United States. They fell again overnight. And at historic lows elsewhere, including in Germany, where 10-year yields are trading at close to minus 60 basis points. Rates in Japan have moved by less, and that appears to reflect the market expectation that the BOJ is not likely to provide a significant additional stimulus. Most notably, though, of course, for this audience, the Australian yield curve has shifted down, and more so than in these other economies over the past year. So as well as helping to reduce risk-free rates, the effect of easier stance of monetary policies is evident in other financial markets. Corporate bond yields have declined this year, and this reflects both the lower government bond yields that I've been talking about already, as well as lower corporate bond spreads, as shown in the right-hand panel of this chart. So one possible interpretation of the low level of corporate bond spreads is that investors' concerns about corporate defaults are about as low as they've been for quite a few years. That's somewhat at odds, though, with significant concern about downside risks to global growth. So it's possible that market participants are placing considerable faith in the willingness and ability of central banks to respond to adverse shocks. Alternatively, record low risk-free rates may be encouraging investors to search for yield, and so they may be underappreciating and underpricing the risks to corporate earnings. Also, for much of this year, equity prices have been supported by the effect of the changing stance of monetary policies on sovereign bond yields. In part, this reflects the rise in the discounted value of future corporate earnings arising from lower risk-free rates. At the same time, market analysts still expect good growth in earnings next year, despite some slowing in earnings growth this year and notwithstanding those downside risks to global growth. Again, this suggests that participants judge that adverse shocks to growth are either likely to have only a modest effect on corporate earnings and or that policy accommodation will help to mitigate the effects of any adverse shocks to growth. However, as seen during the recent ratcheting up of the US-China dispute, asset prices could fall quickly if market participants become more concerned about its potential to weigh on the growth of the global economy and corporate earnings. So the combination of all these changes has underpinned a general easing in global financial conditions through the course of this year. I want to turn now to Australian financial conditions. The transmission to Australian financial conditions of easier monetary policy, both here and offshore, can be traced through the effects on funding costs and on the Australian dollar. The recent reductions in the overnight cash rate in Australia and the decline in interest rates right out that yield curve, that's reduced the cost of funding to historical lows for banks, businesses and households. So here you can see the major banks' funding costs along a few dimensions. Well, the message is that banks' funding costs have declined across the board. The cost of funding in short-term money markets has declined noticeably this year. Much of the fall follows from the decline in the cash rate and the anticipation of a further decline over the coming months, as captured by the rate for the overnight index swaps, or OIS, for short. But in addition to this change in the stance of monetary policy, the spread of the three-month bank bill swap rate to the OIS has declined this year, more than unwinding the increase seen in 2018. Indeed, this spread's declined to its lowest level in many years. Yields on the major banks' bonds have declined in response. As you can see here, it's declined in response to both the lower risk-free yields and the decline in the spread of bank bonds to these reference rates, just like the corporates that I talked about. Also, banks have passed through most of the cash rate reductions to interest rates on retail deposits, which account for about a third of their debt funding. As is typical, of course, the interest rates on transaction accounts, which are close to zero, they've not been changed following the reduction in the cash rate. However, those account for only a small share of the total value of banks' retail deposits. Other at-call deposit rates are estimated to have been lowered by about 40 to 45 basis points, while interest rates on term deposits have fallen significantly over recent months. The banks have passed on these lower costs of funds to borrowers. Interest rates on loans to large businesses, the bulk of which are closely tied to BBSW rates, as many of you would know, they've declined over recent months to very low levels. Lending rates on outstanding loans to small businesses decreased by about 20 basis points following the reduction in the cash rate in June, and that's the latest data we have available. Small business lending rates remain noticeably higher, though, as you can see here, than interest rates for large businesses, and in part that reflects the higher default rates associated with small business loans. Lenders have passed through most of the cash rate reductions to housing interest rates. Following the 50 basis point reduction in the cash rate from June to July, lenders lowered their standard variable rates on housing loans by an average of 44 basis points. So that's the top line here. The extent of that pass-through is broadly consistent with the experience of the past decade or so. Now, the average interest rate actually paid on outstanding variable housing loans in our securitisation data set, they decreased by about 23 basis points in June, and the same as the average announced reduction in the SVR. And similar reductions in outstanding rates are expected to be recorded for the July data, as shown by the dashed line here. So the declines in SVRs are being pushed through to all existing borrowers, which make up the so-called back book. Rates on new loans have also been lowered, and indeed new borrowers and those refinancing existing loans continue to be offered interest rates that are on average well below those applying to existing loans. So that's shown by the label APRA, which is the new loans sourced from an APRA database. Average rates on new loans sourced from the APRA database. So customers who are actively looking around at what's on offer are able to take advantage of the strong competition among lenders that's focused squarely on that front book. Meanwhile, interest rates on fixed rate housing loans have also declined significantly over recent months. Although housing credit growth declined further in June, approvals for new loans increased. And this increase in approvals was broadly based across owner-occupiers and investors, across the different states, and across different types of lenders. It was also consistent with the improved conditions in housing markets, evident in a range of indicators, such as auction clearance rates and housing price growth, particularly in New South Wales and Victoria. If housing conditions continue to improve in the coming months, then we would expect to see a further rise in loan approvals. Finally, I'll say a few words about the exchange rate, given that it is an important part of the transmission of monetary policy. In trade-weighted terms, the Australian dollar has declined by about 7% over the past year or so, and it's now lower than it has been for many years. Now, as you can see here, while commodity prices have declined more recently, they had been trending higher over much of the past year, a time when the exchange rate had been depreciating. But that earlier rise in commodity prices may have been less supportive of the exchange rate than in the past for a number of reasons. First, at least some of the increase in commodity prices over the past year had been expected to be short-lived, given that it was driven by supply disruptions. Second, the rise in commodity prices over the past year or so was likely to have been seen as less expansionary than in the past, and certainly it's unlikely to have supported a boom in mining investment of the like seen a few years ago. And third, the positive effect of the upward trend in commodity prices on the exchange rate might have been partly offset, given downside risks to the outlook for the Chinese economy that could weigh on demand for Australian goods and services beyond resources, things such as education and tourism, for example. Anyway, despite those possibilities, the upward trend in commodity prices that we had seen was still likely to have provided some support to the value of the Australian dollar over much of the past year or so. So despite that support, the Australian dollar had depreciated over the period when commodity prices had been rising. And to me, that implies that the effect of monetary policy on the exchange rate has been broadly working as usual. As I mentioned before, there's been a noticeable decline in Australian interest rates relative to those of major advanced economies. At the two-year horizon, as shown here, this interest rate differential has declined by about 100 basis points over the past year, and this lower return on Australian assets would no doubt have contributed to the decline in the value of the Australian dollar. So just bringing all of this together, I draw the conclusion that the transmission of monetary policy in Australia to financial conditions is working in the usual way. In particular, the change in the stance of policy has underpinned the decline in the risk-free rates right along the yield curve. It's also contributed to a decline in the cost of funding in corporate bond markets, supported equity prices, and lowered the cost of funding for banks, including through lower rates on bank deposits. Much of the reduction in banks' funding costs has been passed through to business and household borrowers, and notwithstanding an easier stance of monetary policy globally, the decline in interest rates in Australia has contributed to the depreciation of the Australian dollar. That broad easing in financial conditions in Australia will provide some additional support to demand in the period ahead. So thank you very much for your attention. I look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much. So we've got time for allocated for a number of questions, and knowing the normal FTA crowd, I know you're advised that you can give us quite a few questions to work through, and Christopher's indicated that he's more than happy to work through whatever we throw forward this morning. So I'm going to just ask if you raise your hand if you have a question. I might just kick us off, and I'll see if... And I have a roving mic here, so if we can use this for asking the questions because we're recording the session. Just make sure this is... Is that working? No. All right. Okay, great technology. So what I might do is if I can just bump Christopher, and I can use this mic a little bit. Oh, do you know how to work that?
Thank you.
Sorry. So, stubborn low inflation seems to have shifted the RBA's chief focus. What is it now? Unemployment, underemployment, or inflation? Is that working now? Great.
Well, we're certainly, as and I said this a little while ago, we're certainly not unemployment rate targeters. We still are inflation targeters, but it's a dual mandate, so we care about inflation, we care about full employment. We care about the general welfare of the populace. I think the thing we've been saying is that there's more spare capacity in the economy than perhaps had been appreciated. And there's a number of reasons for that. We've had very strong employment growth, which would normally eat into that. But we've also had very substantial increase in the participation rate. That's fundamentally a good thing, but it means there's more spare capacity. The other thing we've seen in recent months and around the time that the board, just prior to the board reducing rates in June, was a slight tick up in the unemployment rate, despite that strong employment growth. So the board's objective in reducing rates and providing a bit more stimulus is to try and help soak up a little bit more of that spare capacity. But the idea there is to try and spur on a bit more wage growth and inflation in general and move us towards the target.
So if I can just add on to that question, because we seem to be sitting here in an environment where we've seen interest rates drop down. We see a real fear that interest rates might be going to drop down lower. And we come from an environment where 6 months ago we thought, well, hang on, we're moving along okay. And now we're in an environment where we're worried about what's going to be coming next. And we've got these global headwinds coming that we know are coming from, for instance, from the trade war and maybe some other things that we can't anticipate yet. Are we more fearful than we need to be at this point in time?
Well, I think that is the fundamental risk that collectively, particularly businesses, they're very concerned about these downside risks and the uncertain environment. And in that environment, they're naturally going to hold back on making large investments. Mm. So they're hiring people, and that's not just true of Australia. That's true globally. Labour markets are relatively tight in many advanced economies. So businesses are hiring people, but they're not undertaking really major investments as much as they otherwise would in an environment of that uncertainty. And certainly the trade dispute and the technology dispute, because it has more than just the trade dimension to it, between China and the US, but that's broadening out to other economies. Korea and Japan are having a significant trade dispute at the moment. Those sort of things are potentially going to weigh on people's minds, and there is a risk that that does weigh on business investment. In fact, it has been already. So I think the hope is twofold. One, that some of these can be resolved or at least not get worse from here. And two, the additional support that looks like it's being provided by monetary policy will provide a bit of impetus globally. Mm. There are easier financial conditions globally. That should help spur on a bit of demand.
Justin. Oh,
thank you. excuse me. The governor has recently spoke about the possibility of negative rates in Australia. I just really want to know what you think of the mechanics of that. So in particular, We've looked at our loan docs, and most of them do have the BBSW float at zero. So in particular, will negative rates impact savers more than borrowers?
Well, let me start. So the general discussion's been about sort of unconventional monetary policies. Some people call that quantitative easing, but probably unconventional monetary policies is a broader term. That would include, and in some economies has included, negative rates. I should sort of start by saying I think sort of the need for such policies here is unlikely, but as the governor said, certainly possible. And what we've been doing is studying that overseas experience. And that's a very prudent thing for us to be doing. It's true that some economies pursued very low or even negative rates. I'm not sure. I think one of the lessons, though, that we've taken from the overseas experience is that not all of those policies and not all of their dimensions are necessarily appropriate for Australia. I think it depends very much on your circumstances. Some of the more extreme policies were driven by a desire to really push along credit creation in a financial system that had totally gummed up, where the banks were quite weak. So I think it depends very much on the circumstances, and you'd want to sort of tailor the package. And I think negative rates would be at the more extreme end of that. I think it just, again, I'd emphasise it depends on the circumstances. The problem offshore, the concern, if you like, of authorities offshore where rates have been quite negative is that that can really impinge on the banking system's profits. And if you impinge on the banking system's profits for too long, that impinges on their ability to provide credit. And sort of for the reasons you suggest. Banks haven't been willing to push negative rates through to their depositors for various reasons, including because if they're too negative for depositors, the depositors will just want to demand cash and take that home with them. Right. So I think that's the concern with negative rates. But again, I'd emphasise that I think these things are unlikely, are possible, and a key lesson is depend very much on the circumstances we're facing.
You referred to risk-free rates, which in this context is the sovereign curve. In other comments, the risk-free rate refers to something else, which is the replacement of LIBOR. Could I caution against using the term risk-free rates for sovereign debt? Of the four governments that you had up there, I'm going to call Europe the European, not Germany, credit rating. Only one of them is AAA, and the financial markets have all got material CDS spreads at 10 years. I think to kind of use that the term risk-free when applied to sovereign debt is a misuse of the word, really, because the markets price a risk for everything, and I think one of the problems with lower rates is people are taking more risk to imply something's risk-free when the financial markets clearly tell us it's not.
That's a good issue. I just want to address it very briefly. It's worth reflecting on because I use it in terms of as risk-free as you can get, as low a risk as you can get. But there's a caveat, and you mentioned a couple of examples. But it's risk-free for economies that have their own currency. Right? It's very hard to default when you have your own currency. It's possible to default, more likely to default, of course, if you don't have your own currency, which would be the case of some European economies, or if you've borrowed a lot in someone else's currency, right, and you can default on that. So think Latin America, for example. But I think it's a reasonable point you raise. But I think even without high credit ratings, as high as they had been, some advanced economies that have their own currencies are still able to borrow at extremely low rates. There's very little concern about default because you might be concerned about inflation, but not now, it would seem, because everywhere's experiencing very subdued inflation. But I take your point.
Sorry, I've got a question back
here. You've referred to the continual reduction of interest rates and the passing on of those cuts to both business and household. But I have two questions. Do you think that the fact that you have no longer the qualitative supervision of bank lending practices, such because of APRA's involvement, which dictates what lending, in a sense, can be done? And the second thing is that we have a significant dichotomy in interest rates, that if you can't get money out of the banks, you're into the private non-bank market, and whereas banks, you might get money somewhere between 5 and 8%, you know, for SME in particular. But then in the private market, you could be paying for working capital anything between 15 and 30%, in which case the Reserve Bank's ability to reduce rates is not getting passed on to the economy at large. And more importantly, SME, that is a significant part of business, is not able to sustain those sorts of rates for a long term. So perhaps you might care to comment.
Sure. I don't see it as an issue that the supervision is overseen by APRA, which is separate from the Monetary Authority. It's really not appropriate, I don't think, for them to be sort of moving around their lending standards and their approach to that month to month, like a central bank with monetary policy. Of course, they have made some adjustments recently. That means, at least for households, they've eased some of the tightening there that was imposed by that cap of 7% that banks had to apply when judging someone's borrowing capacity. In terms, I think you raise a good point in terms of this difference between different entities' access to sort of those good rates that I suggested. Most concerning, and we've been noting this for some time, is the fact that large businesses are able to get access to good funding, whether it be through the bond market, where issuance has picked up lately, or business credit growth, the usual channels, at relatively favourable rates, considering the risks. It's a lot harder for small, medium enterprises to get access to that. And indeed, credit or lending to the small businesses has really not picked up. If anything, it's actually dropped a bit in the past year or more. One of the concerns there, I think, is that is just that banks are applying responsible lending obligations to businesses, many businesses, as if they were households. So that's one concern. Another concern had been the fact that house prices had fallen, and they're a key source of collateral for many of these businesses. So we would definitely acknowledge that there's some, it's something you have to watch closely and would have some concern about. It would be good to see a way through this, but I don't think it's easy.
Chris, I just wanted to ask you about the dollar. You mentioned that the transmission mechanism is working because the dollar is depreciating given the rate differential. Just wondering, I mean, we're sort of back to levels against the US dollar, at least we last saw in 2009, when there was, I think, fairly uniformly agreed that we got quite good stimulus from that. The structure of the economy has obviously changed since then. We had a car industry then. We probably had a bit more manufacturing. Are you likely to get the same growth stimulus from a depreciating currency now in a more services-orientated economy than you perhaps would have got 10 or 15 years ago?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got different, slightly different configuration of both exporters and import competing industries. But I wouldn't think it's changed significantly in a way that would mean that the exchange rate wouldn't have a similar effect. The sort of the trade shares as a share of GDP, imports or exports, are similar orders of magnitude, and education and tourism benefit just as much through a depreciation in terms of their competitiveness as any other industries which are no longer so prominent. So, I think it's going to have about the same sort of effect in terms of its stimulus.
Hi, Chris. As rates go to zero globally and central banks struggle to lift inflation around the world, is there a possibility that inflation targeting disappears in the long term, perhaps in favour of something like GDP targeting instead, or another mechanism?
Well, I think I wouldn't imagine it'd be replaced by, let's say, nominal GDP targeting. I think the benefit of inflation targeting is it's pretty simple. It's pretty well understood by the public. I would emphasise that there are a number of advanced economies that are pretty close to their inflation targets. Canada's one. The US was there recently. They've had a soft patch in inflation of late. The UK's another. There are others around. I think it's a simple framework because it really tells it's sort of focused on one measurable item. It tends not to be revised. Nominal GDP gets revised all the time. People can't. I think people on the street don't see it as quite as a tangible thing as the prices of that they're paying for goods and services. It's a more nebulous concept. It's harder to pin down, and it doesn't really address the issue that faced many economies during the time of the global financial crisis and thereafter about the difficulty of running up against the effective lower bound. So that problem is not about having an inflation target, and it's not going to be fixed by just saying let's just target something else or target a different level of inflation. That's about your instrument and looking for a new instrument. So I don't see that is an argument against inflation targeting.
And can I just to carry on that question, can I come back to the discussion or the first question that we talked about is therefore employment that better target because it gives you more of a broad impact across the whole economy in regard to GDP, which is really just focused upon that growth stimulus. So if we think in terms of how we think where we are from a society point of view, I would have thought employment is that better measure to look at.
Well, as I said, we do have a mandate that is trying to pursue full employment. I think one of the tricky elements with that is knowing what full employment is, and indeed that has recently been an issue that we spent quite a bit of time addressing. Structural changes in the economy can mean that NIRU, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment rate, can move around. And it looks like that's been declining, not just here, but that seems to be a global phenomenon. And so I don't think it's particularly helpful to spell out a particular target for such a variable. We'll know when we're there when we get wage growth and inflation consistent with the inflation target. So we're aiming for that point, but not as a target variable. And it certainly doesn't help anchor people's expectations. It's really helpful to anchor people's inflation expectations, just as much as to stop inflation getting too high, as well as to bring it up when it's a bit low.
We probably have time for maybe two or three more questions.
Sure.
Is that all right?
Yep.
We can keep going a little bit. Okay. I think
just one here, Paul, and then we'll go.
Yeah.
Hi. In relation to the RBA's objective in targeting inflation, do you find the fiscal direction of the country to be helping or more of a resisting factor?
Well, I think one thing that we've talked about at some length is the weakness in household consumption and some of the reasons for that. Low wage growth is part of the reason. Offsetting that, we've had stronger employment growth, and wage growth had been picking up. One thing, though, that had been picking up by more had been taxes paid by households. So their disposable income had not been growing by as much as you otherwise would expect, and I think that had had some effect on consumption. So the fact that we've had tax cuts of late, I think that's a particularly helpful thing and is one of the sort of positives I think you can point to in terms of the outlook. Lower interest rates, the tax cuts. We do have a lot more mining investment, it would seem, coming along. There's lots of infrastructure investment. The housing market seems to have turned a bit of a corner and at least stabilised. So all of those are positive elements. Broadly, though, I think you know, it's important to have, in terms of the recurrent budget, fiscal budget, both at a state and a federal level, to have some prudence there. And that prudence provides you options if things go really bad. For example, during the GFC, we had a lot more capacity here than others, and we still do. So I think it is important to have that discipline. But and you can also still, as the governor suggested, you can still build quite a bit of infrastructure without by financing it in different ways that doesn't necessarily impinge on your budget position.
Chris, can I ask whether the RBA has got any concerns about the financial stability of the banking sector in a low interest rate environment? I ask this in the context that larger banks are more easily able to absorb low interest rate environments than, say, smaller ADIs are.
Well, again, that sort of move to the need for unconventional policies, very, very low rates, even negative rates, unlikely but possible. I'll start with that. And then again, I come back to the thing I mentioned before, which is that in what we have done very carefully is study what's happened elsewhere and what they've done. And the lesson for that is you very much want to take account of the structure of your financial system. And an important element, I think, that you raise is that smaller banks might be more impinged at lower rates than others because of their reliance on deposits more so than, say, wholesale markets. So I think it would be an important consideration you'd want to take into account if we found ourselves in those circumstances of needing some of those policies. Again, unlikely, but still possible. Yeah, might have been one question at the very back, I think.
Hey, thanks, Chris. My question is about the reaction function of markets. And in your speech, you mentioned notwithstanding expectations for global policy easing, Australian dollar is still low. There are expectations that other banks will lower. They haven't yet with Fed or ECB. How do you, I mean, you can't really ensure market reaction, but will that put pressure on the RBA to do something more drastic like the RBNZ did to make sure that the policy transmission via Aussie dollar actually is as effective going forward as it is today?
Well, of course, market expectations should already be embedded in those long-term interest rates and those yield curves that I showed you and be behind what we've already seen. Having said that, if it came to pass that the Fed in reasonably short time did actually reduce rates by 100 basis points, I suspect that may have some effects on exchange rates. But in terms of financial conditions, I think even then you have to be a bit careful because that's providing easier global financial conditions. That's providing support to the global economy. So I think you can't just sort of say, oh, well, they're cutting rates and the world remains as problematic as you might have thought it being at the start of that process. The cutting of rates provides more stimulus and support for the global economy, and so that's a positive thing. What it does for exchange rates, hard to know because it should already be embedded in exchange rates. They should be forward-looking and they should already know these low rates are embedded in the yield curve for the US. Whether that comes to pass or not, I'm not sure. We'll have to wait and see. Thanks.
Right, if you can join me in thanking Christopher.